note at all. Nonetheless, it is Stephanie, not Jane, who has the ultimate responsibility for what Stephanie decides to do or not to do. But you don't know Jane. The reason I didn't call, Stephanie explained later, is that Jane would never have let me hear the end of it if I was wrong. If I had woken the vet up in the middle of the night for nothing, Jane would have been on my case for weeks, and she'd have one more reason to label me a neurotic worrier. I love Jane, but you don't know how difficult she can be. She is so sure of herself that it makes me question my own opinions. In this formulation, Stephanie continues to blame Jane for her, Stephanie's, behavior. Of course, if Stephanie does begin to assert her own self, Jane may have an intense reaction, especially if Jane has operated as the dominant partner whenever decisions had to be made. But if Stephanie can stick to her position without emotionally distancing or escalating tensions further, chances are that over time Jane will manage her own feelings and reactions just fine. What are the steps we can take to translate our anger into a clear sense of personal responsibility that will result in more functional relationships with others? Some steps for Stephanie are observation, clarifying the pattern, and gathering data. Observation. Imagine that you are in Stephanie's shoes and feeling angry, not just about the dog incident, but also about the relationship pattern that this incident brought to light. What might be your next step? The first step in the direction of gaining greater clarity about who is responsible for what is to begin to carefully observe the sequences of interaction that lead up to our feeling angry or emotionally intense. For example, Stephanie might observe that the pattern around decision-making often goes like this. A situation occurs, in this case a sick dog, that requires a decision. Stephanie tends to respond first by voicing a rather tentative opinion. Jane then states her own opinion, which may be different, in a supremely confident manner. Stephanie then begins to doubt her initial opinion, or simply concludes that it's not worth the fight. In either case, she defers to Jane. Often this pattern works fine for both of them and things remain calm, but when anxiety and stress are high, as in the present example, Stephanie becomes angry with Jane if the outcome of Jane's decision-making is not to her liking. Stephanie then either withdraws from Jane or criticizes her decision. If she does the latter, a fight ensues, and by the next day, things are usually calm again. Clarifying the pattern. Although she might define it differently, Stephanie is beginning to identify an over-functioning, under-functioning pattern around decision-making. The more Jane over-functions, jumps in to make decisions for the two of them, fails to express any doubt or insecurity about her own judgment, behaves as if she does not benefit from Stephanie's help and advice, the more Stephanie under-functions, spaces out or does nothing when a decision is to be made, relies on Jane to take over, feels lazy or less competent to make important decisions. And the more Stephanie underfunctions, the more Jane will overfunction. Overfunctioners and underfunctioners reinforce each other's behavior in a circular fashion. Approaching a relationship pattern in this way, gathering the objective data about who does what, when, and in what order, is difficult enough when things are calm. It is next to impossible if we are locked into emotionally intense and blaming behavior. We have seen how women learn to be the emotional reactors in our relationships, especially when stress hits, so we may need to make a conscious effort to become less reactive in order to focus our attention on the task of getting the facts. Gathering data. Stephanie will also benefit from gathering some data about how this pattern of relating to Jane fits with her own family tradition over the generations. For example, how did Stephanie's parents, and their parents before them, negotiate issues of decision-making? In Stephanie's extended family, which relationships were characterized by a balance of power, and which marriages had one dominant, over-functioning partner who was viewed as having the corner on competence? How is Stephanie's relationship with Jane similar to and different from her parents' relationship with regard to the sharing of decision-making power? What other women in Stephanie's family have struggled to shift away from the under-functioning position, and how successful were they? As we saw with Katie, our current relationship struggles are part of a legacy that began long before our birth. A familiarity with this legacy helps us gain objectivity when evaluating our behavior in relationships. Birth order is another factor that strongly influences our way of negotiating relationships. In Stephanie and Jane's case, for example, their pattern around decision-making fits their sibling positions. Jane is the older of two sisters. It is characteristic of one in this sibling position to be a natural leader and to believe in one's heart of hearts that one truly knows best, not only for oneself but for the other person as well. Stephanie is the younger of the two sisters in her family, and in the manner of one in that position, is often comfortable letting other people do things for her. Although she may compete fiercely with the leader, she may also shun leadership should it be offered her. Simply being aware that one's sibling position within the family affects one's approach to life can be extremely helpful. If Stephanie finds herself having a hard time taking charge of things, and Jane an equally hard time not taking charge, they will both be able to deal with their situation with more humor and less self-criticism if they can appreciate the fact that they are behaving much the way people in their sibling positions behave under stress. So who has the problem? Let us suppose that Stephanie has taken the following steps since the dog incident. First, she has let go of her blaming position. If anything had happened, you would have been to blame, and has begun to think about, rather than simply react to, the problem. Second, she has pretty clearly figured out who does what, when, and in what order when stress hits. Stephanie underfunctions and Jane overfunctions. Third, Stephanie has thought about how this pattern fits with the traditions in her own family. Finally, she has concluded that she is in a de-selfed position, and that her anger is a signal that she would like to achieve more balance in her relationship with Jane when it comes to decision-making. The following dialogues reflect two modes of using our anger. The first assumes that Jane has the problem, and it is her responsibility to take care of it. The second assumes that Stephanie has the problem, and it is her responsibility to take care of it. Dialogue 1. Jane, you're so damned sure of yourself. You're impossible to argue with because you are always right and you don't really listen to my opinions in an open way. You come on so strong that no one can argue with you. I'm really fed up with your know-it-all attitude. When I give my opinion, you pronounce it true or not true like you're God or something. You make me feel totally insecure about my own thinking. And you always take over and manipulate things to get your way. Dialogue 2. You know, Jane, I've been thinking about the problem that I have in our relationship. I think it has to do with how difficult it is for me to make decisions and take charge of things. I didn't call the vet the other night because when you expressed such confidence in your opinion, I began to doubt my own. And when you were critical of my opinion and put me down for being so worried, which I don't like, I reacted by being even more ready to back down. I'm aware that I do this a lot, and I'm planning to work harder to make my own decisions and stand behind them. I'm sure I'll make mistakes, and our relationship might be more tense for a while, but I'm just not satisfied with things as they are. However, I'm also aware that the women in my family haven't done too well making their own decisions, so it may not be easy for me to be a pioneer in this way. What about Dialogue 1? Some relationships thrive on tough confrontation, and feedback of this sort and fighting it out may be viewed by both partners as a valuable and spicy aspect of the relationship. For all we know, Jane might respond to Dialogue 1 by becoming thoughtful and saying, "You know, I've been told that before by other people in my life. I think you have something there. I'm sorry for coming on so strong, and I'll try to watch it." This dialogue does, however, reflect Stephanie's confusion about the matter of individual responsibility. Can you spot the problem? She holds Jane responsible for Jane's behavior, putting Stephanie down, which is fair enough, but she also holds Jane responsible for Stephanie's behavior, feeling insecure and manipulated and failing to stand firmly behind her own opinion, which is not fair at all. Blaming of this sort blurs the boundaries between self and other in a close relationship. What about dialogue two? Here, Stephanie shares something about herself and does not assume to be an expert on Jane. She talks about her own dilemma in the relationship and takes responsibility for her own participation in the pattern. While dialogue one might lead to a further escalation of an already stressful situation, dialogue two would probably calm things down a bit and foster greater objectivity on both women's parts. Which dialogue better suits your personal style? For me, it depends on the relationship. With my husband, Steve, I sometimes dissipate tension by fighting dialogue one style, although with less frequency and intensity as I get older. At work, however, and during visits from long-distance friends and family, I end up feeling much better if I communicate in dialogue two style. And I find that these relationships do better, too. It all depends on what the circumstances are, what your goals are, and what in the past has left you feeling better or worse in the long run. Of course, what is most important is not what Stephanie says to Jane, but what she does. Next time around, perhaps Stephanie will listen to Jane and consider her perspective, but then take responsibility to make her own reasoned decision about what she will and won't do. Stephanie's communication style will make little difference if she does not modify her own under-functioning position. As we learn to identify relationship patterns, we are faced with a peculiar paradox. On the one hand, our job is to learn to take responsibility for our thoughts, feelings, and behavior, and to recognize that other people are responsible for their own. Yet at the same time, how we react with others has a great deal to do with how they react with us. We cannot not influence a relationship pattern. Once a relationship is locked into a circular pattern, the whole cycle will change when one person takes the responsibility for changing her or his own part in the sequence. Assuming this responsibility does not mean we take a self-blaming or self-deprecating position. Learning to observe and change our behavior is a self-loving process that can't take place in an atmosphere of self-criticism or self-blame. Such attitudes frequently undermine, rather than enhance, our ability to observe relationship patterns. They may even be a part of the game we learn to play, in which the unconscious goal is to safeguard relationships by being one down in order to help the other person feel one up. In contrast, it is a position of dignity and strength that allows us to say to ourselves or others, "You know, I observe that this is what I'm doing in this relationship, and I'm now going to work to change it." Such owning of responsibility does not let the other person off the hook. To the contrary, we have seen how it brings our separateness into bold relief and confronts others with the fact that we alone bear the ultimate responsibility for defining ourselves and the terms of our own lives. It respectfully allows others to do the same. Who's doing the housework? After countless housework battles with her husband, Lisa decided to cease and desist from the old fights and begin to clarify her own problem. She chose a moment when things were relatively calm and close between them and said, "Rich, I'm having a problem with the amount of housework I do. When I take on more than half the responsibility for cooking and cleaning, I end up feeling resentful because the way I see it, I'm pulling more than my fair share of the load. I'm exhausted as well. I guess my biggest problem is that I'm tired too much of the time and I need to find a way to conserve my energy and have more time for myself." Then Lisa told Rich specifically what she would like him to do in order to help out. Lisa did not criticize her husband or instruct him on how a good man behaves. Rather, she was sharing her feelings about a situation that had become increasingly problematic for her. When Rich said, "Well, other women I know seem to manage just fine," Lisa said lightly, "Well, I'm not other women. I'm me." Several months later, Rich was doing nothing more than taking the garbage out and tending to yard work, and Lisa was still angry. As she and I talked, however, I became aware that she had made no change in her own behavior. As usual, she was entertaining Rich's colleagues, doing his laundry, cooking dinner, washing the dishes, even vacuuming his study. Lisa's words were saying, "I'm tired and resentful, and I need to do something about it." Her actions, however, were maintaining the status quo. She was not taking responsibility for doing something about her problem. But why should she? Isn't Rich the one who should change his behavior? Is it not his responsibility to behave fairly and considerately toward his wife? Lisa is forever trying to initiate change in this relationship. So isn't it Rich's turn? You and I may think so, but that's beside the point. Rich does not have a problem with the current situation. He is satisfied with things as they are, and he's not interested in making a change. If Lisa does not proceed to take care of what is her problem, no one else will do it for her, her husband included. When the day came that Lisa could no longer stand her predicament, she began to make her actions congruent with her words. First, Lisa figured out a plan. She made a list of tasks that she would continue to do. For example, a clean living room and kitchen were extremely important to her, so she would not let things pile up here. And a list of those that she would no longer do. For these, she hoped that Rich would fill in. But if not, they would just live without their being done. Then she shared the plan with Rich and put it into force. Lisa stood behind her position as Rich tested her out for 2 months by becoming even more of a slob than usual. Lisa continued to do more of the housework because a clean house was more important to her than it was to Rich. She found other ways, however, to save her time and energy. For 3 nights a week, she made sandwiches for her and the kids for dinner and let Rich prepare his own meals when he came home from work. If Rich invited his friends or colleagues to dinner, she did not shop or cook for the event, although she was glad to help out. Lisa carefully sorted out where she wanted to put her time and energy and where she could conserve it. Lisa made these changes out of a sense of responsibility for herself, not as a move against Rich. If she had gone on strike, or this was no more than a plot to shape Rich up or to get back at him, the probable outcome for this couple might well have been an escalation of their difficulties. As a postscript, I might add that as Rich made some changes of his own, Lisa, in reaction, made some counter moves. If you recall, "please change" and "change back" are the mixed messages that we often give each other. When Rich took the initiative to do housework, Lisa was right there to offer unsolicited advice or to criticize him for not being thorough enough. To ask a person to do more housework or parenting and then say, "do it the way I would do it," or "do it the way I want you to," is a move that blocks change. If Lisa is truly ready to have Rich more involved with the housework, which means that she is willing to give up some control in this area, she must also be ready to let Rich do it his own way. If she wants him to stop underfunctioning in this area, she must be willing to stop overfunctioning. Obviously, Rich may never clean house up to her standards, which are likely to be different from his. However, if Lisa can credit his attempts and truly stay out, unless he asks for her advice or feedback, his housekeeping skills will get better in time. Lisa had an additional problem as Rich began to change. She not only wanted him to do more of the housework, she wanted him to want to. "He did the dishes last night," she moaned, "but he sulked and pouted for the rest of the evening. It's just not worth it." Again, we see Lisa's discomfort with change. Sulking and pouting is Rich's problem, and it is not Lisa's business or responsibility to fix or take away his feelings. Although no one has died from sulking yet, women, the emotional rescuers of the world, can have a terribly difficult time allowing others just to sit with their feelings and learn to handle them. If Lisa can avoid becoming distant and critical, and if she can allow Rich the space to sulk as he pleases without reacting to it, his sulking will eventually subside. But when she says, "it's just not worth it," this is Lisa's problem and reflects her own mixed feelings about changing a long-standing relationship pattern. Why should it be easy for Lisa to relinquish control in an area where female authority and competence have gone unquestioned generation after generation? When Lisa does housework, she is linked to her mother, to her grandmothers, and to all the women who have come before. It is part of her heritage and tradition, to say nothing of the fact that homemaking is important and valuable work, no matter how little recognition it gets. Sure, housework can be tedious, and daily living easier when it is shared, but it is understandable that Lisa may have some complicated feelings about it all. And perhaps Lisa has few other areas where she, rather than Rich, can assume the role of the competent expert. One last question. If Lisa is serious about change, why not a good let-it-all-hang-out fight? Can't Lisa let Rich know by the volume of her voice that she really means business? Nothing is wrong with fighting if it leaves Lisa feeling better, and if it is part of a process by which Lisa gains a greater clarity that she will not proceed with things as usual. In ongoing battles of this sort, the single most important factor is not whether we fight or not, or whether our voice is raised or calm. It is the growing inner conviction that we can no longer continue to overfunction, in Lisa's case, on the domestic scene, for our own sake. Emotional overfunctioning. More women's work. Earlier, we noted the ways in which deselfing and underfunctioning are prescribed for women, and so they are. Thus, when we have our own area of overfunctioning, we may do it with a vengeance, while complaining all the way, as Lisa did with housework. In addition to picking up someone else's socks, how else are we likely to overfunction? Often in relationships, women overfunction by assuming a rescuing or fix-it position. We behave as if it is our responsibility to shape up other people or solve their problems, and further, that it is in our power to do so. We may become reactive to every move that a person makes or fails to make, our emotions ranging from annoyance to intense anger or despair. And when we realize that our attempts to be helpful are not working, do we stop and do something different? Of course not. As we saw with Sandra and Larry, Chapter 3, we may redouble our unsuccessful efforts, only to become angrier and angrier at that under-functioning individual who is not shaping up. What a difficult time we may have maintaining the degree of separateness that allows others the space to manage their own pain and solve their own problems. Men also have this difficulty balancing the forces of separateness and togetherness. However, they tend to handle anxiety by emotional distancing and disengaging, thus sacrificing the we for the I, whereas women more frequently handle anxiety by fusion and emotional overfunctioning, thus sacrificing the I for the we. The sex role division for these two unhappy and out-of-balance alternatives is hardly surprising. Our society undervalues the importance of close relationships for men and fosters their emotional isolation and disconnectedness. Women, on the other hand, receive an opposite message that encourages us to be excessively focused on and fused with the problems of others, rather than putting our primary worry energy into our own problems. When we do not put our primary emotional energy into solving our own problems, we take on other people's problems as our own. But what is wrong with taking responsibility for others? In some respects, nothing. For generations, women have gained both identity and esteem from our deep investment in protecting, helping, nurturing, and comforting others. Surely connectedness to others, empathy and loving regard for our fellow human beings, and investment in facilitating the growth of the young are virtues of the highest order for both women and men. The problem arises when we are excessively reactive to other people's problems, when we assume responsibility for things that we are not responsible for, and when we attempt to control things that are not in our control. When we overfunction for another individual, we end up very angry, and in the process, we facilitate the growth of no one. The saga of overfunctioning will come more clearly to light as we unravel the story of Lois and her brother. As you read, keep in mind that it could as easily be Lois and her son, her grandfather, her mother-in-law, her employee, or her friend. My brother is a mess. I don't mean to sound unsympathetic or callous, explained Lois, who sounded as if she was about to disown her younger brother, Brian. Obviously, I'm very concerned about Brian because he's so screwed up. But I also find myself angry with him. Two things that he does irritate the hell out of me. First, he always calls in the middle of some kind of crisis and wants to borrow some money and ask for advice. Then he spends the money, which he never pays back, and ignores the advice. I've referred him to two therapists, but he didn't stick with it. I've suggested books for him to read to get his life together. I've talked on the phone with him when he calls me, collect, of course, and I tell him what he can do to get his act together. Brian listens, and then he doesn't do it. I've tried some tough confrontation, and that doesn't work, either. I'm feeling drained, and I'm feeling angry. Yet he's my brother, and I can't turn him away. He's alienated my parents, and he has nowhere else to go. What is the pattern of interaction between Lois and her brother? Brian calls, saying help. Lois jumps in to help. Brian then continues his old ways, and sooner or later he calls again with a new crisis. Lois takes either a tough or a sympathetic approach, but in either case, she continues to tell her little brother, who is 24 years old, how to shape up. Brian does not shape up. Lois gets angry, and the cycle continues. So, who is to blame for this merry-go-round? Hopefully, by now, you are no longer thinking in these terms. Relationships are circular. A and B are mutually reinforcing. Rather than linear, A causes B or B causes A. Once a pattern is established in a relationship, it is perpetuated by both parties. What is Lois's part in keeping the circular dance going? The more she overfunctions, the more Brian will underfunction, which means that the more Lois is helpful, the more Brian will need her help. The more Lois fails to express her own doubts, vulnerability, or incompetence to Brian, the more Brian will express enough for both of them. The more emotional Lois gets about Brian's problems, the more he won't care enough about himself. Lois's big sisterly sense of responsibility may have many positive aspects. Nonetheless, she is functioning at the expense of her brother's competence. Does this mean that Lois is responsible for her brother's problems? Not at all. She does not make Brian incompetent to manage his life any more than Brian makes Lois rescue him. Lois's role as rescuer and Brian's as rescuee have their roots in family patterns that can be traced back for generations. They are each responsible for their own behavior, and Lois's behavior is 50% of the problem she complains of. What are your thoughts about the specific steps Lois might take to change it? What about sharing her problem with Brian in a non-blaming way? Lois could approach him when things are calm in their relationship and say, "When you call me to ask for money and advice, my initial reaction is to give it. But after I give it and I see that it hasn't really helped, I start to feel resentful. Maybe it's partly from my own wish to be helpful that I end up feeling frustrated. But I don't want things to continue this way. Please don't ask me to lend you money unless you can pay it back. And please don't ask me for advice if you're just going to do your own thing anyway." It won't work, or at least it won't change the pattern. Communication of this sort is preferable to blaming Brian. "Brian, you're an exploitative, irresponsible, manipulative psychopath." Or interpreting his motives. "I think you are using me." Nonetheless, if Lois wishes to change this overfunctioning, underfunctioning pattern, she cannot do so simply by expressing her feelings or asking Brian to change. She will have to stop overfunctioning. What specifically does this mean? Learning how not to be helpful. If Lois wants to change the old pattern with Brian, she can put the brakes on being helpful. Sounds simple? For those of us who believe it is our sacred calling to save other people and shape them up, the hardest thing in the world is to stop trying to be helpful. How does one go about not trying to be helpful? How does one stop rescuing another family member? Here's an example. The next time Brian calls Lois in distress, Lois can listen sympathetically and ask him questions about his situation. And she can say in a low-keyed way, "It sounds like you're really having a hard time, Brian. I'm sorry to hear that." If Brian asks her for money, she can say, "I've decided not to lend you any more money, Brian. There are a bunch of things that I'm saving for, and I've decided that's my first priority. You're on your own, kid." If Lois can do this with warmth and humor, all the better. For example, if Brian says accusingly, "That's selfish," Lois might say, "You're probably right. I think I'm getting more selfish in my old age." If Brian courts her advice, Lois can bite her tongue and say, "Well, I really just don't know." Or, "I wish I could be helpful, but you know, Brian, I just don't know what to say." Then Lois might proceed to share a little bit about what she is currently struggling with and perhaps ask Brian if he has any thoughts about her dilemma. Another thing Lois can do is to express confidence in Brian's ability to find his own solutions. "I know you've been struggling for a long time to get on top of things, but I have faith that you'll eventually work it out. I think you're a really bright guy." Learning how not to be helpful requires a certain attitude toward relationships and an ability to strike the right balance between the forces of separateness and togetherness. If Lois's tone is, "Don't try to involve me, it's not my problem," the old pattern won't change. This is a reactive and distancing position. Similarly, if Lois says, "Well, I'm not going to give you any advice or money from now on because it's not good for you, Brian," she is simply doing another variation of her therapeutic, "I really know what's best for you" attitude. Learning how not to be helpful requires a certain attitude toward relationships and an ability to strike the right balance between the forces of separateness and togetherness. If Lois's tone is, "Don't try to involve me, it's not my problem," the old pattern won't change. This is a reactive and distancing position. Similarly, if Lois says, "Well, I'm not going to give you any advice or money from now on because it's not good for you, Brian," she is simply doing another variation of her therapeutic, "I really know what's best for you" attitude. Learning how not to be helpful requires that we begin to acknowledge that we do not have the answers or solutions to other people's problems. In fact, we don't even have the answers to all of our own. What's wrong with advice giving? Does this mean that Lois should never, ever offer Brian advice for as long as they both shall live? Down the road a bit, as the pattern starts to shift, Lois might give Brian advice if he asks for it and if she observes that it's useful. But there is advice giving, and then there is advice giving. There is nothing wrong with giving another person advice. "This is what I think," or, "In my experience, this has worked for me." As long as we recognize that we are stating an opinion that may or may not fit for the other person. We start to overfunction, however, when we assume that we know what's best for the other person and we want them to do it our way. If Lois feels angry when Brian does not follow her advice, that's a good indication that she should not be giving it. It is also the case that those closest to us may have the greatest difficulty considering our advice if we come across as though we have the final word on their lives. Lois's typical style, for example, is to lecture Brian about the importance of his getting professional help, and then to get angry at him for not following through. Brian would have a better opportunity to evaluate this option if Lois were to say, and only if asked, "Well, therapy has been pretty helpful to me in my own life, so I'm all for it. But not everyone is alike, and you may be more of a do-it-yourselfer. What do you think?" Giving advice in this way is not just a strategic move. It is a mature approach that takes into account the separateness and otherness of her brother. Further, it acknowledges that people are different, and that we all have the ability to become the best experts on our own selves. Hanging in. As we saw with Maggie and her mother, there is hardly anything more important than emotionally hanging in. especially when we are shifting a pattern. Lois's task is to show her concern for Brian at the same time that she stops trying to help him solve his problems. How can she do this? Lois can call Brian while he's having a hard time, simply to touch base with him. She might say, "I know I'm not much help to you at this time, but I just wanted to hear how you're doing and let you know that I care about you." She might increase her contact with Brian and invite him to have dinner with her family. Stepping back and allowing the other person to struggle with his or her own problems is not the same as emotional withdrawal. Lois can stop trying to bail Brian out, yet still express her support and interest as he goes through a difficult time. Maintaining emotional contact is never easy at this point in a changing relationship. Our natural tendency may be either to fight or to emotionally distance ourselves because we are uncertain about our position and how to maintain it in the face of pressures to do otherwise, a big part of which is our own anxiety about really changing. Hanging in requires us to move against enormous internal resistance, which is most often experienced as anger. Why should I get in touch with him when he's acting this way? Or inertia. I just don't feel like taking the initiative. Sharing our underfunctioning side. In therapy sessions, Lois discussed her problems and pain with me, but within her own family, and especially with Brian, she was always fine and didn't need anything from anybody. Like all good over-functioners, Lois was convinced that sharing her struggles and vulnerability with Brian was absolutely out of the question. "I would never tell Brian that I was depressed. I have absolutely no desire to do so, and he has more than enough problems of his own. Brian can't deal with my feelings. Why burden him? There is no way he can be helpful to me." The relationship between Lois and Brian was extremely polarized, with Brian expressing only his weakness and Lois only her competence. If Lois wants to shift the old pattern, she can present a more balanced picture of herself and begin to share a bit about her own travails with Brian. For example, when Brian calls to talk about his recent crises, Lois can say, "Brian, I wish I could be more useful, but I'm no good for much of anything right now. In fact, I've been feeling lousy all day. I'm sorry you're feeling bad, but I just don't have much energy to give to anyone else. Part of the problem is that I've been feeling dissatisfied with my job for a long time. But today it really came to a head and I got real down in the dumps." If we are dealing with depressed or underfunctioning individuals, the least helpful thing we can do is to keep focusing on their problems and trying to be helpful. The most helpful thing we can do is begin to share part of our own underfunctioning side. Ah, yes. Counter moves. Finally, Lois must be prepared to deal with Brian's counter moves. As sure as the sun rises in the morning, Brian will up the ante and attempt to reinstate the old pattern. If he has been requesting money to help pay his electric bills, his next request is bound to find him starving to death or about to be thrown in jail. This is the point at which we are truly put to the test. We either give ourselves an excuse to go back to our old ways and blame the other party. "Well, I couldn't let my own brother die in the streets, could I?" Or we sit with some anxiety and guilt and maintain our new position. If Lois can calmly continue not to rescue Brian or attempt to solve his problems while offering him emotional support and contact, his countermoves are likely to decrease rather dramatically. They will pop up only periodically as he tests out the waters of their relationship over time. What light does Lois's story shed on the question we started out with? Who is responsible for what? It provides us with a good example of how we may be too responsible for another person and at the same time not responsible enough for our own behavior. Lois is feeling angry because she assumes too much responsibility for her brother's problems. She advises, rescues, and bails Brian out. She has difficulty simply being there and letting him struggle on his own. At the same time, however, Lois does not assume enough responsibility for examining how her own behavior contributes to the pattern she's so eager to change. She is stuck in a position that blocks her from reflecting upon her situation and figuring out how she can take a new stance that will free her from the old rules and roles. While it is hard to change in the short run, there are long-term costs of maintaining the status quo. Most obvious are the costs for Brian. Lois is a devoted big sister, but by persisting in her unsuccessful attempts to advise and rescue her brother, and failing to show him her own vulnerable side, she is doing the least helpful things that one can do with an under-functioning individual. Less obvious, but no less important, is the price that Lois pays personally for the position she holds in this relationship, as evidenced by her chronic anger and high level of stress. When we overfunction, we may have a difficult time allowing others to take over and care for us, so that we can just relax or have the luxury of falling apart for a little while. Lois, the caretaker and helper for others, has lost sight of her own needs and challenges of continued growth, which she can sweep under the rug because she needs to care for her brother. By continuing to feel responsible for the other party, Lois ends up under-functioning for her own self. Anger at kids. Self-blaming and child-blaming remain an occupational hazard for many mothers today. What's wrong with me? And or what's wrong with this child? Are the two questions that mothers learn to ask themselves as they are handed over the primary responsibility for all family problems. We have fostered in mothers the omnipotent fantasy that their child's behavior, their very being, is mother's doing. If the child performs well, she is considered a good mother. If poorly, a bad mother, who caused the problem. It's as if the mother is the child's environment. Until recently, father, the family, the society in which the family is embedded, all these did not really count. As mothers, we are led to believe that we can and should control things that are not realistically within our control. Many of us do feel an excessive need to control our children's behavior, to prove to ourselves, to our own mothers, and to the world that we are good mothers. However, the mother who is dominated by anger because she feels helpless to control her child is often caught in that paradox that underlies our difficulties with this emotion. We may view it as our responsibility to control something that is not, in fact, within our control, and yet fail to exercise the power and authority that we do have over our own behavior. Mothers cannot make children think, feel, or be a certain way, but we can be firm, consistent, and clear about what behavior we will or will not tolerate, and what the consequences are for misbehavior. We can also change our part in patterns that keep family members stuck. At the same time, we are doomed to failure with any self-help venture if we view the problem as existing within ourselves, or within the child, or the child's father, for that matter. There is never one villain in family life, although it may appear that way on the surface. Angry power struggles with kids often boil down to this. We may overfunction or move in too much when it comes to their thoughts and feelings. At the same time, we may underfunction when it comes to clarifying our own position and setting rules about behavior. Here is a typical example. Claudia, a 4-year-old dictator. Alicia, who had been divorced for several months, was starting to date a man named Carlos. "I like him, but my daughter doesn't," Alicia explained. Whenever Carlos and I are about to leave the house together, Claudia, who's 4, begins to sob mournfully as if her little heart is breaking. Perhaps it has to do with her loyalty to her father, but she just doesn't like Carlos, and she doesn't like me to be alone with him. She treats him rudely and refuses to speak to him. Sometimes she has a full-blown temper tantrum when the two of us are about to walk out the door. I feel such rage at her that I can't even be sympathetic. "And what do you do when Claudia does these things?" I inquired. "When I'm feeling calm, I try to reason with her," explained Alicia. "I let her know that I need to go out and that there is no reason for her to be upset about it. I tell her that soon she'll get used to my going out and then it won't bother her. I explain to her that Carlos is a very nice man and that if only she would make the effort, she would like him."
"And how does your daughter react?" I asked.
"She just doesn't listen to reason. She'll climb under the covers or put her hands over her ears. Or she'll get even louder and more upset. Last week it was so bad that I cancelled my plans with Carlos and sent him and the babysitter home. Usually I go out, but then I feel so guilty that I don't enjoy myself. I know that Claudia is having a hard time with the divorce, but I end up furious with her for being so controlling. That kid is a little dictator. What is going wrong here? Can you identify Alicia's problem? Reasoning with kids? Reasoning with kids sounds like a good thing for any enlightened parent to do. In practice, however, it usually boils down to trying to convince them to see things our way. Alicia communicates to Claudia that Claudia's anger and distress are wrong, excessive, or uncalled for. Alicia not only wants to date Carlos, she also wants her daughter to want her to date Carlos. She not only wants her daughter to cut out the rude behavior, which is certainly a reasonable request, she also wants Claudia to like Carlos and to think that he is a nice man. It makes perfect sense that Alicia wishes that this were the case, but it is not possible to change our children's thoughts and feelings. More importantly, it is not our job. Trying will only leave us feeling angry and frustrated. It will also hinder our child's efforts to carve out a clear and separate I within the family. Why is Alicia having such a difficult time simply accepting her daughter's feelings of anger and sadness? Perhaps Alicia herself is anxious about going out, although she may not be aware of it. Perhaps she overfunctions or rescues when it comes to other people's feelings, especially those of her child. So many of us do this. As soon as our son or daughter expresses sadness, anger, hurt, or jealousy, our first reaction may be to rush in and do something to take it away or to make things better. The something may be to give advice, interpretations, or reassurance. We may try to change the subject or cheer the child up. We may try to convince our child that she or he doesn't or shouldn't feel that way. Emotional overfunctioning reflects the fusion in family relationships. Family roles and rules are structured in a way that fosters overly distant fathering and overly intense mothering. If our child itches, we scratch. This togetherness force between mother and child may be so strong that many of us have difficulty achieving the degree of separateness that would allow us to listen to our children in an empathetic, low-keyed way, inviting them to talk more and elaborate as they wish. When we learn to stay in our own skin and avoid assuming an over-functioning or fix-it position, children, whether they are 4 or 40, demonstrate a remarkable capacity to manage their own feelings, find solutions to their problems, and ask for help when they want it. What would you do in Alicia's place? Claudia calmed down considerably when Alicia was able to take the following 3 steps. First, Alicia listened to Claudia's thoughts and feelings without trying to change them or take them away. She did not offer her daughter advice, reassurance, criticism, interpretation, or instruction. Instead, she made empathic, non-fix-it statements, such as, "It sounds like you are pretty angry that I'm going out tonight. You really don't like Carlos very much, do you?" Claudia felt reassured by her mother's calm, non-reactive listening, and she began to more openly express her anger, fears, and unhappiness about her parents' divorce. Alicia felt as though a burden had been lifted from her shoulders when she learned to listen to her daughter's problems without having to do something. Second, Alicia realized that it was her responsibility to make her own decisions about dating Carlos, or about anything else for that matter, and that these decisions were not based on her daughter's emotionality.
Alicia communicated that she respected her daughter's feelings and took them into account, but that she would not make her decisions in reaction to her daughter's emotional outbursts. For example, Alicia would say, "I know you are having a hard time tonight, but Carlos and I are still going to the movies and then out to dinner. I'll be home at about 11:30 after you are asleep." And when Claudia said tearfully, "I hate him," Alicia simply replied, "I understand that." Claudia, like all children, was ultimately reassured to know that she could express the full range of her thoughts and feelings, but that her mother was separate and mature enough to take responsibility for making her own independent, thought-through decisions, for herself and for Claudia as well. In the old pattern, Alicia would give in to Claudia and then angrily blame her for being manipulative. That kid always gets her way. Third, Alicia took responsibility for setting clear rules about behavior and enforcing them. For example, throwing a tantrum was unacceptable behavior. If Claudia did this, Alicia would pick her up and take her to a room, where she would have to stay until she calmed down. Alicia also clarified that it was not acceptable for Claudia to continue to ignore Carlos whenever he spoke to her. "You don't have to talk to Carlos if you don't want to," Alicia said to her daughter, "but if he asks you a question, tell him if you don't want to talk about it instead of just ignoring him." For several weeks, Claudia proceeded to say, "I don't want to talk about it," every time Carlos initiated a conversation. Alicia decided that she could live with this behavior. Alicia also observed that the more she pursued her daughter to relate to Carlos, and the more Carlos attempted to move closer to Claudia, the more Claudia distanced. She and Carlos were both able to back off a bit and provide Claudia with the space she wanted. When Claudia no longer felt pressured to like Carlos or to feel close to him, she felt more comfortable and relaxed in his presence, and in time she began to warm up to him. With children as with adults, change comes about when we stop trying to shape up the other person and begin to observe patterns and find new options for our own behavior. As we sharpen our observational skills, some patterns may be easy to identify. I notice that the more I ask Claudia to discuss her feelings about the divorce, the more she closes up. But when I leave her alone and calmly share some of my own reactions to the divorce, she will sometimes begin to talk about herself. Other patterns that involve three key people are more difficult to observe, as we shall see in the next chapter. Chapter 8. Thinking in Threes. Stepping out of family triangles. Recently, I visited my parents in Phoenix. I made this particular trip because my father, who prides himself on having made it to age 75 without even a sniffle, suddenly had a heart attack. It was a wonderful visit, but after I returned, I found myself feeling intense surges of anger toward my children. During the next few days, Matthew began waking up with headaches. Ben became increasingly rambunctious, and the boys fought constantly with each other. My two children became the prime target for my free-floating anger. As I talked my situation over with my friend Kay Kent, a sensitive expert on families, I began to make the connection between my anger toward my children and my visit home to my parents. The good time that I had had with my parents was a reminder, not only of the geographical distance between us, but also of how much I would miss them when they were no longer around. On this particular visit, I could no longer deny their age. My father was tired, considerably slowed down, and easily out of breath. My mother, a spirited survivor of two cancers and a recent surgery, seemed her usual self. However, I was all too aware of her mortality. Kay suggested that I address this new awareness directly with my children and parents, and so I did. At the dinner table the following night, I apologized to my whole family for being such a grouch and grump, and I explained to Matt and Ben that I was really feeling sad following my Phoenix trip because Grandma and Grandpa were getting old, and Grandpa's heart attack was a reminder to me that they would not be around forever, and that one of them might die soon. That, I explained, is why I've been so angry.
I also wrote a letter to my folks, telling them how much I had enjoyed my visit, and how after my return home I had come in touch with my concerns about their aging, and my sadness about my eventual future without them. What followed was quite dramatic. Both boys relaxed considerably, and the fighting diminished. Each asked questions about death and dying, and inquired for the first time about the specifics of their grandfather's heart attack and grandmother's cancer. I stopped feeling angry, and things returned to normal. The following week I received a letter from my father, who gave only a perfunctory reply to my self-disclosure by suggesting I not dwell on the morbid side of life. In the same envelope, however, he enclosed a separate, lengthy letter to each of the boys, explaining how the heart works and exactly what had happened in his own case. He concluded his letter to Matthew by directly addressing the subject of death. These letters, which were factual and warm, began the first correspondence between the two generations. Underground issues from one relationship or context invariably fuel our fires in another. When we are aware of this process, we can pay our apologies to the misplaced target of our anger and get back on course. I'm sorry I snapped at you, but I had a terrible day with my supervisor at work. I'm scared about my health, and I guess that's why I blew up at you. I've been angry at everybody all day, and then I remembered today is the anniversary of my brother's death. Sometimes, however, we are not aware that we are detouring strong feelings of anger from one person to another, or that underground anxiety from one situation is popping up as anger somewhere else. It is not simply that we displace a feeling from one person to another. Rather, we reduce anxiety in one relationship by focusing on a third party, who we unconsciously pull into the situation to lower the emotional intensity in the original pair. For example, if I had continued to direct my anger toward my misbehaving boys, who, in response, would have misbehaved more, I would have felt less directly anxious about the life cycle issue with my aging parents. In all likelihood, I would not have identified and spoken to the real emotional issue at all. This pattern is called a triangle, and triangles can take many forms. On a transient basis, triangles operate automatically and unconsciously in all human contexts, including our family, our work setting, and our friendship networks. But triangles can also become rigidly entrenched, blocking the growth of the individuals in them and keeping us from identifying the actual sources of conflict in our relationships. The example below illustrates first a transient, benign triangle, and then a problematic, entrenched one. A triangle on the home front. Judy is a real estate agent, and Victor, her husband, is a salesman for the telephone company. On this particular day, Victor has a meeting after work and phones Judy to tell her that he will not be home until 7 o'clock. Judy has been with the children all afternoon and finds herself tense and tired by the time the evening meal rolls around. She cooks dinner for the children, who, sensing her mood, act out more than usual, which only puts a greater strain on her. She cleans up and watches the clock for Victor to come home. At 7:30, Victor walks through the front door. "I'm sorry I'm late," he says. "There was an accident on the road and I got stuck." It is an entirely reasonable excuse, but Judy is furious.